stream into the lobby. Suitcases are unloaded from the belly of the coach and stacked near the registration desk. Emlyn Tunnell, entering his 13th year in the league, dean of black ball players, knows the routine and hangs back. Whites only. The four black Packers must stay at a black hotel on the other side of town. But Tunnell forgets to tell the rookie about another Jim Crow edict. Stay outside. Don't even go in. Wood enters the lobby searching for his suitcase. A porter moves swiftly, intercepts him near the door, and stiffly escorts him to the sidewalk. Four suitcases are finally hauled out for the four black players. There's a taxi by the curb. Wood opens the back door and starts to get in. No, wrong cab. White cab. You can't get in a white cab. Have to catch a black one. He hasn't played a game yet, and he's ready to explode. He's reminded, inevitably, of something worse that happened to him back during his first year in California, when he was playing for an otherwise all-white junior college out in the valley near Fresno, and his team arrived in the little town of Santa Maria. The local sheriff drove over to the hotel and announced that the colored player, Willie Wood, would be quarantined in his room that afternoon. No way he was going to be allowed to play on the same field with white boys. Parched Valley of California, River Crescent of New Orleans, little difference. What about Green Bay? In the isolated province of northeastern Wisconsin, Wood and his black teammates, Tunnell, rookie receiver Paul Winslow, and second-year defensive end Willie Davis, acquired from Cleveland, were strangers in a strange land. The four black Packers used to say that they constituted four-fifths of the permanent black population of the city, the fifth being the shoeshine man at the Hotel Northland. Now and then, you might see a black guy down near the train station or at the Y, just passing through, Wood said. This was a slight exaggeration. According to the 1960 U.S. Census, 128 blacks then lived in Brown County, but this was still only about 0.01% of the total population. Wood couldn't imagine the racial homogeneity of Green Bay was happenstance. There were no blacks there, and we just automatically assumed that none were there because nobody wanted them there. So you also automatically just assume that your stay there would be unpleasant. Green Bay citizens didn't seem hostile so much as uninformed on matters of race. During Wood's first month in town, he encountered a woman who remarked that she had never met a Negro before, and that she was surprised he seemed so polite. She'd only read about you folks fightin' and fussin' in Chicago all the time. The trailblazer for black players in Green Bay had been Bob Mann, a gifted end from the University of Michigan who arrived in 1950 after playing briefly for the Lions and stayed five seasons. During Mann's time in Green Bay, the local newspaper referred to him as a colored athlete until he finally took sports writer Art Daly aside one day and said, "We don't want to be called colored, we're Negroes." Daly pleaded ignorance. He had grown up in Fond du Lac, without ever knowing a black person. "I don't know why I used colored. Dumb shit I was. I wouldn't think of using that today," Daly reflected more than 40 years later. Jim Crow segregation was not in effect in Green Bay, but private housing was largely unavailable to black players during the 1950s and at the beginning of Lombardi's tenure. Their living quarters were so inadequate that the married men among them chose to keep their families away during the season. Mann had lodged in a trailer. Davis and Winslow shared a run-down bungalow behind an industrial lot, and Wood spent his rookie year at the downtown YMCA, where his bill was $1.50 per night, a modest rent that he reduced even further by checking out before road trips. M. Tunnell, a bachelor who loved the high life of Harlem nightclubs, where he was as much a celebrity as Billy Eckstein, found a room at the Hotel Northland at the corner of Adams and Pine, one block from the Y. "Yes, your Hotel Northland has kept pace," boasted the establishment in its advertisements. The proof? 2 automatic elevators, the most modern hotel desk in the Middle West, along with a new coffee shop, bay room, and dining room. Despite these amenities, Tunnell was excruciatingly bored in the dead old building in a ghostly white town. But at least the old man secretly picked up his tab. Lombardi respected and needed Tunnell's experience that much. "I'd get out of this town if it wasn't for Vince," Tunnell told a visiting reporter from New York. "He's real brass, real arrogant. He's the kind of guy you have to cuss out once a week when you're alone. But nobody else can cuss him out to me. In my heart, I know what he is." Tunnell could offer no more impressive endorsement of his coach, and his black teammates felt the same way. Wood called him perhaps the fairest person I ever met. Race was an issue that revealed the integrity of Lombardi's character. In later years, he would try to explain his position on racial matters by saying that he viewed his athletes as neither black nor white, but Packer green. He insisted that there were no barriers on his team, and all things were equal, racially and socially. He was colorblind, he said. And though this was literally true, Lombardi was colorblind. There was more to it than that. It's always been easy for whites to claim color blindness in the United States since white is the dominant color in American society, but the claim often serves as a ruse for not recognizing the particular obstacles faced by non-whites. Lombardi might have seen only one color on the football field, but he wasn't blind to the discrimination that his black players encountered off the field. And he did everything he could to ease their way in an alien environment. During his first year in Green Bay, Lombardi called his team together on the practice field and delivered a rare lecture on racism. "If I ever hear nigger or dago or kike or anything like that around here, regardless of who you are, you're through with me. You can't play for me if you have any kind of prejudice." His actions that year were more often quiet and behind the scenes, like paying Tunnell's hotel bill when it was hard to find suitable housing, or making sure the black players had enough money to go to Milwaukee or Chicago on off days. But as his status and power increased in his second season, his sensitivity to racial inequities intensified as well, and his responses became more overt. Before the season began, Lombardi spread the word among Green Bay's tavern and restaurant owners that any establishment that didn't welcome his black players would be declared off-limits to the entire team. At Tunnell's suggestion, he allowed the black players to leave the St. Norbert training camp twice during the preseason for quick trips down to Milwaukee, the closest city where they could find barbers who knew how to cut their hair. The Jim Crow discrimination that black Packers faced when the team played exhibition games in the South enraged Lombardi. And at the end of the 1960 preseason, he decided that he would never again allow his team to be split by segregation. "From then on," he said, "any hotel that wouldn't accommodate all Packers would get no Packers." The final preseason game that year was held in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, against the lily-white Washington Redskins. According to Lombardi lore, an event took place there that solidified the coach's decision to no longer submit his team to the segregation policies of the South. As the story goes, Lombardi, his naturally tawny skin further darkened by a month of practice sessions under the summer sun, entered a local restaurant the night before the game and was refused seating by a hostess who mistook him for a black man. There's no documentation of the episode. Decades later, no one remaining from that team could remember precisely who was with him that night. And there are many apocrypha in the legend of St. Vincent of Green Bay. But this story nonetheless rings true. Lombardi told it to his family later, and to many of his players, and there was no reason for him to concoct it or exaggerate it. The black players often joked among themselves that by the end of summer camp, their coach was a secret brother. In any case, The all-for-one edict from Lombardi followed that trip to North Carolina. When he took the Packers into the Deep South the following summer for a game against the Redskins in Columbus, Georgia, he lodged the players at Fort Benning, the integrated army post, so that they could all stay together. Lombardi had been keenly aware of the sting of prejudice long before his supposed black-like-me experience in Winston-Salem. He'd gone through life being called a Dago and Wop and Guinea because of his dark skin and southern Italian heritage. Throughout his school years, he'd struggled to overcome the lower academic expectations that society seemed to have for Italian boys. In high school and college, he'd tried to dress more sharply, scrub cleaner, keep his hair trimmer, and maintain a more businesslike appearance, just so that he would not be defined by stereotypes. At Fordham, he'd risked suspension from the football team by tackling and punching a teammate who taunted him in the shower with ethnic epithets. At various points during his long apprenticeship and coaching, he'd suspected that his advancement had been slowed by bias against Italians. But the world teems with people who are sensitive to prejudice only when it's against them, not when they're inflicting it on others. Lombardi's concern seemed universal, not merely self-centered. There was evidence of this even when he moved in the most racially exclusive circles in Green Bay, such as his country club, Oneida Golf and Riding. Among the caddies at the all-white private club were several members of the Oneida Indian tribe who lived nearby on the western rim of Green Bay. Big Elroy and Ray Bear were legends at the course, said to know every blade of grass along Duck Creek, able to anticipate the slightest shift in wind. It was tradition for the Native Americans to caddy in the spring, when local teenagers were in school. But the minute school let out, we'd take the white kids from school. Then when the kids went back to school, we'd take the Indians again, said Jack Kepler, the insurance man who often played in the same foursome with his pal Lombardi. Kepler said the men at the club followed that pattern, with one exception. Lombardi insisted on using Indian caddies year-round. "If they're good enough for spring and fall, they're good enough for summer," he once said. The first time he was greeted at the practice tee by a teenage boy instead of Big Elroy, Lombardi stormed back to the clubhouse and loudly berated the club pro. He was a generous tipper to his caddies and became a one-man, interest-free lending institution as well. Indians in a financial pinch would appear behind the 18th green, taking a silent position down by the trees at the bottom of the hill, sometimes with wives and children, and wait for Lombardi to finish his round. Invariably he would greet them, listen to their stories, and provide the needed funds. The Trinity of Life, as Lombardi often described it, was God, family, and the Green Bay Packers. He placed them in that order, though his family, in reality, if not in his idealized image, usually came in third, unable to compete in his heart and mind with his dual passions of God and the Packers. There's been a tendency in recent decades to mix sport and religion in the most superficial public ways, with athletes proclaiming that God healed an injury or guided the winning shot, that a comeback victory was the Lord's work, as though the Father and Son, if not the Holy Ghost, were taking sides and cared one whit about the outcome of games. It would be difficult to find someone who conjoined sport and religion more deeply than Lombardi. But as an old-line Catholic trained by the Fordham Jesuits, he accomplished this in a more personal way, without proselytizing. He wasn't the sort to pray explicitly for victory over the Chicago Bears, but he could worry that his team might lose if he failed to pray before the Bears game. This was part raw superstition, part his sense that God cared not about the Packers or Bears, but about the act of prayer itself. Prayer was the essence of Lombardi's religious practice and the constant of his daily routine. Before he left Sunset Circle each morning, he fell to his knees in his bedroom and prayed to St. Anthony and St. Jude, their statue likenesses sitting atop his dresser above the sock drawer, icons he'd carried with him since his days at Saints. Here was Lombardi, the winner, praying to saints of loss and miraculous recovery. Jude for the impossible, the lost cause. Anthony for finding what was lost, the lost key or lost emotion. O holy Saint Anthony, gentlest of saints, your love for God and charity for his creatures made you worthy when on earth to possess miraculous powers. Miracles waited on your word, for which you were ever ready to speak for those in trouble or anxiety. Encouraged by this thought, I implore of you to obtain for me this request. The answer to my prayer may require a miracle. Even so, you are the saint of miracles. The statues were ceramic, each a foot high, robed in green and blue paint, with the barefooted Saint Jude revealing the Holy Spirit through the portal of an eternal flame burning atop his forehead. In his coat pocket, Lombardi carried old black wooden rosary beads. He'd rubbed his long, thick fingers over these same beads, uttering Hail Marys and Our Fathers, since studying for the seminary at Cathedral Prep. He even equipped his car for the purpose of prayer. Snap-on rosary beads looped around the upper half of the steering wheel, allowing him to count off the decades while taking Susan to school or heading on to the office. The beads were fluorescent, so that he could perform his prayerful obligations while driving at night. It was his usual practice to pray silently, but in the mornings during the 6 weeks of Lent, as he was driving Susan and her neighbor friend down to St. Joseph's Academy, he would recite the rosary aloud all the way to town and demand that the girls in the back stop gossiping and begin praying aloud along with him. By his side in the car or at home were two religious books. The first was a new Holy Name edition of the Catholic Bible, a treasured present he'd received the previous spring, abundant in red leather, featuring full-color reproductions of masterpieces of religious art, photographs of the Vatican, the Sistine Chapel, and the magnificent churches of Rome, and biographies of American cardinals. Inside were two black-and-white snapshots that his children had no idea he carried with him. One was of young Vincent and Susan playing in the backyard in Englewood at ages 6 and 1. The other showed Susan as a pixie-faced 6-year-old at West Point. Resting atop the Bible was a smaller book, a black leather-bound Mary Knoll missal containing the prayers and responses for celebrating Mass. Inside, as bookmarkers, were two laminated holy cards. One featured a line from Ecclesiastes. Be in peace with many, but let one in a thousand be thy counselor. Another, handwritten, offered a prayer in case of unexpected death. My God, if I am to die today or suddenly at any time, I wish to receive this communion as my viaticum. I desire that my last food may be the body and blood of my Savior and Redeemer, my last words of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, my last affection, an act of pure love of God and of perfect contrition for my sins, my last consolation, to die in the holy grace and in thy holy love. Amen. That was among the prayers he whispered every day at his first stop, St. Willibrord, an old Dutch Catholic church near his office that was named for the patron saint of Holland and run by the Norbertines. St. Willibrord was a sturdy rectangle of orange brick and light stone dominating the corner of Adams and Doty, with a dark shingled steeple rising to the low-slung northern sky. The church had taken on a new sheen at the time of Lombardi's arrival, its exterior sandblasted, thousands of bricks replaced, new plastic paint applied, and a 6-foot statue of Christ the King, made from hard white Italian Carrara marble, erected on the south lawn. As a downtown institution convenient to urban professionals, St. Willibrord was among the more ethnically diverse churches in town. The French had St. John the Evangelist and St. John the Baptist, the Poles St. Mary of the Angels, the Belgians St. Peter and Paul and Holy Martyrs, the Irish St. Patrick, and the Germans St. Francis Xavier Cathedral. Lombardi was a daily communicant at St. Willibrord's 8 o'clock Mass, parking in the back lot, slipping in the side door, and taking a pew near the white altar below an alignment of saints shining down from stained-glass windows. His daily ritual was so precise and predictable that Jim Huxford, who worked the sideline down in distance chains at Packers games, knew that if he drove by at 7:56 each day, he could wave to the coach entering the church. Altar boys, who regularly assisted when the priest served Lombardi wine and wafer, noticed that his tongue was oddly serrated, bitten into jagged edges, perhaps from years of anxiety. Lombardi fit comfortably into the religious culture of Green Bay, one of the most Catholic regions in the nation. Even Alloway, the suburb in which the Lombardis lived, had a Catholic origin. It was named for Claude Alloway, a Jesuit missionary and educator. Nearly three of every four residents of Green Bay identified themselves as Catholic. The parochial schools had as many students as the public school system. There were two Catholic high schools and 10 Catholic elementary schools. Among the 16 Catholic churches, worshippers could choose from 42 masses during the week and 94 masses every Sunday, the earliest starting long before sunrise at 4:30 a.m., the latest beginning at 10 minutes past noon, only when the Packers were out of town or not playing. During the off-season or when the Packers were playing at home on Sundays, Lombardi attended Mass at St. Matthew's Parish Church in Alloway, and later a new church there, Resurrection, taking a seat next to Marie near the center aisle about six rows back. The priests knew he was there but tried not to look at him. One confessed later that if he made eye contact with Lombardi, "The sermon was shot. Forget it. Just looking at him would throw you for a loop. He was so intense it was difficult to concentrate after catching his gaze." But for the most part, outside the church, priests and nuns were made to feel at ease around Lombardi, who'd been accustomed to their presence in daily life since his Sheepshead Bay childhood. There was no such thing as a practice session too secret for his friends in the clergy. Reporters would get the boot, but if Lombardi saw a priest hanging out on the other side of the gate, he was known to shout, "Hey, those are my agents, let them in." He was also a soft touch for nuns seeking tickets. They gobbled up a significant share of his 50-seat allotment. Some priests had no need for tickets. Lombardi would give Father Burke game passes for himself and several fellow Norbertines. They stood on the sidelines near the bench. Players joked on game day that it was hard to tell which Lombardi wanted more, to win or to get to heaven. He wanted both, of course. On rare occasions, he might introduce a touch of religion into his coaching by quoting a line from Scripture that he thought would inspire his troops, but he didn't invoke God or Jesus in his locker room pep talks. In a sense, there was no need for that. The currents of sports and spirituality within him converged at a deeper point than mere rhetoric. The fundamental principles that he used in coaching, repetition, discipline, clarity, faith, subsuming individual ego to a larger good, were merely extensions of the religious ethic he learned from the Jesuits. In that sense, he made no distinction between the practice of religion and the sport of football. His religious side, in one sense, did serve as a necessary antidote to his football obsession. In order to be the best coach, to keep winning, to stand out from his peers, he understood that at some level, he had to be imbalanced, to sacrifice his family, to use some of his darker characteristics, especially his volatility, to his advantage. His temper and impatience, he once said, were characteristics that he was never able to subdue wholly. To some extent, he regretted this, but he also feared that if he'd been more in control of his emotions, he would not have coached effectively. His daily prayers were an effort to balance the tension between his will to succeed and his desire to be good. His son Vincent, as he sought to understand his father's motivations over the years, later revealed perhaps the clearest appreciation of the contradiction at the center of Vince Lombardi. "He went to Mass to repent for his anger," Vincent explained. "He thought, 'I've got this temper. I fly off the handle and offend people. I apologize. But it's this temper that keeps me on edge and allows me to get things done and people to do things. Life was a struggle for him. He knew he wasn't perfect. He had a lot of habits that were far from perfect. His strengths were his weaknesses, and vice versa. He fought it by taking the paradox to church. It went back to the Jesuits and the struggle between the shadow self and the real self, your humanity and your divinity. He saw that struggle in clear and concrete terms. Today it requires an intricate computer program analyzing thousands of variables to construct a season schedule for the National Football League. But during Lombardi's early years with the Packers, the task was simple and the pattern predictable. Even in 1960, when the league expanded to Dallas and briefly became imbalanced with 13 teams, Lombardi began every year knowing that he would open with four home games, three in Green Bay and one in Milwaukee, and that near the end of the year he would be competing mostly in enemy stadiums with a traditional Thanksgiving Day contest against the Lions in Detroit and a December road trip finale to the West Coast for games against San Francisco and Los Angeles. The schedule seemed a reasonable adjustment to the weather, front-loading home games for the early fall and escaping to California for the harsh northern winter. But the lack of balance also meant that the Packers couldn't afford slow starts. They had to take advantage of the early run in Wisconsin and couldn't falter down the stretch during the pressure games on the road. The pattern of those early schedules seemed to shape the rhythm of Lombardi's teams. His rigorous training camps and pedagogical methods were designed to build teams that were mentally and physically strongest during the first quarter and the fourth, at the start of every season and at the end. The Packers opened the 1960 season with the opposite rhythm, losing at home to Chicago 17-14 when the Bears came back and scored all of their points in the fourth quarter. Disaster seemed possible, with the talented Detroit Lions and two-time champion Baltimore Colts visiting Green Bay for the following two Sundays. But the Packers won both games handily, launching a four-game winning streak that carried them to the top of the standings by early November. If the first humans were produced by thunder and lightning, as the Winnebago Indian tradition held, the same was being said of these Packers. Thunder was Jim Taylor, the bruising fullback, on his way to his first 1,000-yard season. And lightning was Paul Hornung, the left halfback, who had an uncanny knack for finding the end zone and lighting up the scoreboard on his way to a record-shattering 176 points. Taylor and Hornung were about results, nothing more. Other backfields around the league were bigger and faster, but none produced like thunder and lightning. It was said of Taylor that he loved contact so much that if no defensive backs were in his way, he would go find one. To watch Hornung run at midfield was nothing special. He seemed a step slow and uninspired. But near the goal line, he was the best. Unstoppable. The predictable mid-season slump began at Baltimore in the sixth game. Lombardi knew it would be a trying day. The Colts, especially the passing combination of Johnny Unitas and Raymond Berry, had been all too familiar to him since the famous sudden-death championship game in 1958, his last as an assistant coach with the New York Giants. Unitas and Berry were at their prime now, each on his way to a record year, and the Packers' secondary was hobbling. During pregame warm-ups, Jesse Whittington, the speedy left cornerback, pulled a leg muscle. In his fifth professional season out of Texas Western, Whittington was the most talented of the Katzenjammer kids. The nicknamed defensive coach Norb Hecker gave his devilish Lone Star backfield trio of Whittington, Hank Greminger, and Johnny Simank. When the Colts game began, Whittington tried to cover Berry, but he limped to the sidelines in pain halfway through the first quarter, and Lombardi instructed Hecker to put Wood in there. Willie Wood was a safety, being tutored to replace M. Tunnell, and had never played the corner before. But when Hecker asked him if he could handle it, he nodded yes and sprinted onto the field. As soon as he arrived, shouts of, "Number 24, number 24," came from the Baltimore bench, signaling Unitas that an untested rookie was in the game. Unitas immediately started flinging passes Barry's way, one hitch pattern after another, with the hesitant Wood arriving a second late every time. Finally, Wood said to himself, "If he runs another hitch, I'm going to come up and be right there." Barry ran it, and Wood arrived quickly, only to discover that it was a fake. Unitas pumped, and Barry took off deep, getting behind the Packers' secondary for a long completion. They yanked Wood from the game after that, and tried another young player, Dick Pisonin, who fared no better. Barry finished with 10 catches for 137 yards, totals matched by the fleet flanker Lenny Moore. At the airport after the game, as the team waited for the charter flight back to Wisconsin, Willie Davis and Jim Ringo and several other teammates started ribbing Wood.
"You live in D.C., don't you? Ain't no need for you going back to Green Bay. Might as well stay here, 'cause they're gonna send your ass home anyway."
Wood thought they had a point, until Lombardi overheard the conversation and took his rookie aside.
"Don't you believe anything those fellas say. You're not going anywhere," Lombardi told him. "You're staying right with me. Every one of those guys making fun of you has had the same thing happen to them. You're going to be here as long as I'm here."
It was the longest conversation Wood had ever had with his coach, and the most meaningful. Until then, he hadn't been sure where he stood with Lombardi. He was embarrassed, his confidence shaken, by the way Barry had beaten him. Were the NFL scouts right not to draft him? Lombardi waited until the precise moment when it would mean the most, when Wood was doubting himself, and then assured him that what had happened to him was no big deal, that there would be hundreds of other days of redemption, and that the coach believed in him. "He gave me confidence when he did that. I said, 'What I'm doing has got to be right because the man believes in me,' Wood said later. 'I think it made a hell of a better ball player out of me.'" Hell of a better ball player, indeed. When Lombardi bucked up his rookie that day at the airport in Baltimore, it might be said that Willie Wood started his long and improbable leap toward the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The losing continued. The Packers dropped two of their next three games, and they headed home from Detroit on Thanksgiving evening after a 23-10 loss with a middling record of 5 wins and 4 losses. Taylor and Hornung were still going strong, but the quarterback position seemed uncertain again. Starr had been throwing too many interceptions, and Lamar McCann performed no better when given the chance. It might have been a dispiriting holiday, lonely and lost, but once again the coach showed a knack for pulling things together at the critical moment. Instead of lambasting his players for their mistakes, 2 fumbles and a punt blocked for a safety, he let them drink 2 beers on the flight home, spoke spiritedly to them about how they would right themselves for the rest of the season, and later that night brought them all downtown to the Elks Club with their families for a turkey dinner. The old man could be gruff, awkward, unrelenting, but now he showed another side. All night long he moved from table to table, slapping backs, chatting with wives, joking with kids, inviting them to watch cartoons from a projector that had been set up downstairs, embracing everyone as part of his big, happy brood. Watching him that night, Bob Skoronski thought of him as the total father figure for the whole group. If only for a few hours, Lombardi was fulfilling a deep longing. Not on the football field, not yet, but here at dinner, among his Packers, he'd close the mystical gap between the hugeness of his desire and the smallness of reality. He might be silent and distant at the dinner table on Sunset Circle, but at this moment he seemed transported in time back to those childhood Sundays at the family homestead on East 16th Street among the bountiful Izzos of Sheepshead Bay. Chapter 14.
Remembering Jack. On the Sunday after Thanksgiving, shortly after 10 in the morning, Jack Vanese collapsed in the bathroom of his house at 1017 Reed Street, 2 miles from City Stadium. By the time the rescue squad arrived, he was gone. Dead at the age of 33 from a chronic rheumatic condition that had swelled his heart to twice its normal size. He left behind a pregnant wife and 2 young daughters and one of the most exceptional and underappreciated careers in professional football. While Lombardi lives on in American culture, Vanese is lost in the oblivion of minor sports figures of the past. On the day that he died, the Packers were still recovering from their defeat in Detroit 3 days earlier. Most of the players spent the afternoon at home, watching the televised game in which conference-leading Baltimore was upset by San Francisco, a result that allowed Green Bay to slip back into the championship race, 1 game behind the Colts. In a sense, it was then, on that cold November day in 1960, that Lombardi and his Packers began their long run to greatness, beginning an era of dominance that wouldn't have been possible without the work of an accomplished young personnel man who'd suffered through 9 losing seasons and then died before he could witness the wonder of a team that he, almost as much as the famed Lombardi, had built. It was Vanese who had persuaded the Packers executive board to hire Lombardi in the first place, and he who'd scouted and recommended most of the players on the 1960 team, going back to Hog Hanna from Arkansas in 1952, and including 7 future NFL Hall of Famers. Halfback Paul Hornung from Notre Dame, quarterback Bart Starr from Alabama, Louisiana State fullback Jim Taylor, Illinois linebacker Ray Nitschke, offensive tackle Forrest Gregg from Southern Methodist, center Jim Ringo from Syracuse, and free agent Willie Wood from Southern Cal. Other talented starters scouted by Vanese were Idaho offensive guard Jerry Kramer, Michigan tight end Ron Kramer, offensive tackle Bob Skoronski from Indiana, receiver Max McGee from Tulane, flanker Boyd Dowler from Colorado, Southern Methodist linebacker Bill Forrester, Michigan State linebacker Dan Curry, Purdue linebacker Tom Bettis, defensive back Hank Greminger from Baylor, and safety Johnny Simank from Florida. Which is more important, the talent of the troops or the skill of the leader? That's one of the central questions of all group enterprises and can be debated forever, but remains essentially unresolvable. The fact that Vanese's hand-picked Packers had played on losing teams before Lombardi's arrival, including Scooter McLean's hapless 1958 squad, showed the profound difference a coach could make. But if Lombardi found the best in his players, their performance in the end was limited by what that best could be. Lombardi inherited an uncommonly talented collection of athletes when he came to Green Bay, and Jack Vanese realized that before anyone else. Even more than Lombardi, Vanese was a creature of football. He grew up on the north side of Chicago in the embrace of the Chicago Bears family. His classmate at St. Hilary's Grammar School was George Halas Jr., known as Muggsy, the son of the Bears coach. Bears players would visit St. Hilary's to help a priest coach the 8th-grade football team on which Jack played. One of the Bears, Big George Musso, presented young Jack with a complete pro uniform, which he wore at every opportunity. Vanese's father operated Tony's Fine Foods, a grocery and delicatessen that served as a hangout for many Bears who roomed across the street at the Sheridan Plaza Hotel during the season. At least once a year, a carload of Bears would drive over to the Vanese home for a 5-course Italian meal cooked by Jack's mother. At St. George High School, Jack became an all-Chicagoland lineman on a powerhouse scholastic team that traveled to New York to play for the mythical Catholic school's championship. Notre Dame offered him an athletic scholarship in 1945, and he played as a freshman there under Hugh DeVore, who had been among Lombardi's coaches at Fordham a decade earlier. After one season at South Bend, Vannisi was drafted into the Army and sent to occupied Japan, where he worked at MacArthur's headquarters and played on a service team favored by the football-loving general. He became sick there with what doctors misdiagnosed as scarlet fever. Months later, after Vannisi had returned to the service team, he discovered that he'd been suffering from the far more serious rheumatic fever, and that the strain of playing football had permanently damaged his heart. He was brought back to Chicago, where he recuperated for several months at Hines Military Hospital near his home, then returned to Notre Dame and finished his studies. No longer able to play football, he devoted himself to the sport anyway and decided that he would make his career in the front office. With his connections and enthusiasm, it took him only a few months after graduating in 1950 to land a job scouting for the Packers. The new head coach in Green Bay was Gene Ranzani, one of the Bears who dined at Mama Vannisi's. And Ranzani's top assistant was the same Hugh DeVore who'd coached him at Notre Dame. As a scout, Vannisi was ebullient and innovative. He worked the telephones and traveled relentlessly in search of his boys, developing contacts with hundreds of high school and college coaches around the country, and was so engaging that competing pro coaches, his favorites were Paul Brown and George Halas, took his calls without fail and talked football talent with him. For his honeymoon in 1952, he persuaded his wife, Jackie, to escort him on a trip through Oklahoma, Texas, and Alabama, where he spent most of his time signing new players. He developed a network of informal tipsters as well, many of them former Packers or friends from Notre Dame. His scouting reports, in 18 thick blue canvas three-ring notebooks, ranked and coded the statistics of nearly 4,000 players. He became known around the league as a boy wonder, lending Green Bay a measure of respect that it couldn't gain on the football field. Head coaches came and went, first Ranzani, then Blackburn, then McLean, each more frustrating to him than the last. He pushed especially hard for the Packers to take Paul Hornung, the Heisman Trophy winner from his alma mater, as the first bonus pick in 1957, then fretted for 2 years as coaches played the golden boy at the wrong positions and seemed unable to unleash his talent. Lombardi was his salvation, a paisano who understood what he'd been doing. They'd known each other for years through mutual friends, and they shared the same passion for football and a desire to make the Packers a first-class organization. When the Packers began recruiting Lombardi, he bluntly informed the executive board that he wouldn't have considered Green Bay if Vannisi hadn't been there. He didn't tell them the full reason, that Vannisi was already on his side. It was Vannisi who'd warned Lombardi that he had to demand full power as both coach and general manager, or the board of directors would persist with petty interference in the football operation. Jack was too much of a gentleman to ever say so, but he loathed most of the board members. His wife said later, "They were small men." Most of the board members were in Green Bay's social elite, members of Oneida Golf and Riding, and despite their awe of Lombardi, their attitudes tended to be condescending toward Italians. "There's the Italian Mafia," was one of their common salutations when Lombardi and Vannisi were seen together. They smiled when they heard it, but considered the statement a slur, and after a time made a point of being seen together less often in social settings. Both men were in a hurry to win. Lombardi, because he'd waited so long to get his chance. Vannisi, because he feared he wouldn't have much longer. After every close game, he would mutter only half-jokingly that he didn't know whether his heart could survive the tension. "I could go at any time," he said one morning during the 1960 preseason to his pal Art Daly, the beat reporter for the Press Gazette. The two men were taking a stroll around Bear Mountain near West Point, where Lombardi had brought the team for a week of practice. Vannesi was always a hulk, standing 6'1", with immense shoulders and hands, but by then he'd become seriously overweight, busting the bathroom scale at the maximum reading of 250 pounds. He smiled at Daly and patted his weak spot, his huge and fragile heart. "I'd like to see something good happen to the club. You know how it's been for all these years." Months later, after the Thanksgiving Day drubbing by the Lions, he appeared more troubled than usual. The Packers had lost twice in 5 days. There were only 3 games remaining. The season-closing swing on the West Coast, but before that, the Bears, the team of his childhood, at Wrigley Field in Chicago. With the rest of the coaching staff, he was working 18-hour days. "This is it," he said that Friday at his desk at the Packers' office on Washington Street. "We gotta win now." That Sunday morning, he and Jackie had returned from 9 o'clock Mass and were preparing to visit her parents' house in Green Bay for a late-morning coffee. Jackie took their 2 girls upstairs to change clothes, and Jack went into the bathroom. He never came out. His heart stopped, and he slumped to the tile, jamming the door with his massive body so Jackie couldn't get in. She went around the side of the house and looked through the small bathroom window to see her worst fear realized. Her husband dead on the floor. She called the paramedics and her parents and then Lombardi, who came over with Marie. Word spread through the Packers' team. Jack was dead. Vannesi was close to all of them. He was always doing something special for the players, finding circus tickets for Jim Taylor's family, giving Bob Skoronsky a $500 bonus to pay off his furniture bill at Sears, arranging travel plans for the wives, finding off-season jobs for guys who wanted to stay in Green Bay, letting them know if they were in danger of being cut. "We're all deeply shocked," Lombardi said to the press. "I have lost a close, personal friend. I had known Jack several years before I came here. It will be hard to do without him." On Monday it began to snow, and the weather turned colder, and the Packers scrimmaged inside City Stadium instead of at their normal outdoor practice field on Oneida Street. Their sessions preparing for the crucial Bears game, as Art Daly described them, were grim and quiet, and conducted with a heavy heart for their lost scout. Lombardi seemed more determined than ever, but kept his voice down, offering soft words of encouragement. On Wednesday morning they practiced at 8:30, and were finished in time to attend Vannesi's 11 o'clock funeral mass at the Church of the Annunciation. Players lined both sides of the entrance as the heavy casket was carried inside the church. The nuns at Annunciation's grammar school next door let their students watch, eager little faces pressed against cold windows, as the team escorted the coffin out to the hearse and on to Alloway Cemetery. Paul Hornung approached Jackie Vannesi and asked if there was anything he could do. "Yes," she said. "Become the kind of football player Jack knew you could be." He'd been Jack's favorite, she said, the one who could make the Packers great. Later that week, Hornung vowed that the Packers would beat the Bears in Jack's honor. The year before in Chicago, he'd played his worst game as a pro, fumbling 3 times, but this time would be different, he promised. It certainly was. The Packers played their finest game under Lombardi that Sunday. It was the most lopsided Green Bay win to that point in their long history against the rival Bears, even more uneven than the 41-13 score. Willie Davis, the rangy defensive end, blocked a punt and pounced on the ball in the end zone for 1 score. Jimmy Taylor plowed for 140 yards, Bart Starr, back on target and feeling confident again, completed 17 of 23 passes for 227 yards. And Hornung was incomparable, running for 68 yards, catching 3 passes for 32 more, scoring 2 touchdowns on a 10-yard run and 17-yard pass, and kicking 5 extra points and 2 field goals for a total of 23 points, establishing a record season total of 152 points after only 10 games. After his second touchdown, Hornung casually tossed the ball into the stands, a gesture that infuriated Hallis, a notorious penny pincher and sore loser. Papa Bear threatened to seek a league fine against Hornung for the unusual gesture. "Don't worry," Lombardi said to Hornung. "If he tries to do something, I'll pay for it." Lombardi had walked off Wrigley Field with a ball of his own, the one that had been in play when the game ended. He wrote the date and score on it, passed it around the locker room, and asked all the Packers to sign it. And when he arrived back in Green Bay, he gave the game ball to the widow of his fallen friend, Jack Vanisi. The Colts lost again that Sunday, and suddenly Green Bay was in a 3-way tie for first place with San Francisco and Baltimore, all with 6-4 records. The Western Conference title was within reach for Lombardi if his team could sweep the final 2 games on the West Coast. With the college regular season over and the pro schedule featuring the Packers and 49ers in a lone Saturday matchup on December 10th, the game drew the attention of the National Sports Writing Corps, which would jump at any excuse to be in San Francisco. Football tends to be most exciting and poetic on either a crisp and radiant autumn afternoon or its opposite, a monsoon or a snowstorm. San Francisco on that Saturday offered lousy conditions in full glory. A chill rain turned old Kazar Stadium into a muddy slop pile, the turf soft and slippery. Tex Mall was there for Sports Illustrated and had brought along a New York illustrator and photographer named Robert Reiger, who'd been shooting pictures for a book with Mall titled The Pros, a documentary of professional football in America. The images Reiger came away with that day were taken too late to appear in the book, but were among the most evocative he ever made. They had a mythic, ennobling quality to them, their character enhanced by the brutal conditions, each picture revealing another element of what it meant to be a pro, as the Packers under Lombardi were coming to define the term. Click. Here comes the horn, Paul Hornung, with the square toe of his kicking shoe flashing, looking for a hole behind the blocking of Jim Taylor and Fuzzy Thurston on a sweep. Click. There stands quarterback Bart Starr, coldly watching, after making the handoff, as Jim Taylor cuts back, and mighty Jerry Kramer crumples one man and looks downfield for more. Click. Here looms Forrest Gregg, the square-jawed offensive tackle, his face and helmet smeared in mud, shouting from the bench as a Packer defender intercepts a pass. This photograph, entitled simply Mud, became a classic on its own, winning the grand prize in Look magazine's sports photo contest. Click. There paces Lombardi in his lucky camel's hair coat and brown fedora, as Reiger describes him, our friend the coach, the universal symbol stalking the sidelines, smoking his cigarette, his mind fixed on one idea alone, the next play. Considering the field conditions, the Packers played their second near-perfect game in 6 days. With its high-flying passing game, San Francisco was stuck in the mud and never scored. Lombardi had Starr handing off the ball most of the day and throwing only one pass in the second half. Taylor bulled past the 1,000-yard mark for the season with 161 yards on 25 carries. "You're as tough as a rat," linebacker Ray Nitschke snarled at him after the game. And Hornung
ran 19 times for 86 more yards, including a classic sweep around the left end for a 28-yard touchdown in which his timing behind the blocks of his guardian angels, Thurston and Kramer, was so perfect that the 49ers never touched him. He scored all of Green Bay's points in the 13-0 win. On the bus after the game, Reiger took a seat next to the coach and found him in an unusually chatty mood. Lombardi talked with the photographer for nearly 40 minutes, diagramming plays on the back of Reiger's airline ticket and praising his tandem of thunder and lightning. "Taylor has great balance, and he can cut quickly, and our best play is a simple fullback slant," Lombardi said. "He can run it over tackle, and if that hole closes, he can come back over the center, or he can swing wide outside. Three plays right there off one, because Taylor makes them work." When it was noted that Hornung now had stretched his single-season scoring record to 165 points, Lombardi raved. "That Hornung is some ball player. That's an awful lot of points for one man to score in one season. I don't see how anyone will score more. It was just a simple sweep for the touchdown. The two guards pulled and gave him an alley, but the key was the flankers, Dowler's block on the safety. When he got that, he was in." When he was asked about the defense, Lombardi praised the play calling of his old safety, Emlyn Tunnell. He roared that rough Lombardi laugh and added, "Their shotgun offense backfired." Then, as Reiger later recounted it, the coach perfectly distilled his football philosophy into one statement. "You know, I think that spread formation is a lot of junk. You play this game with your power. You do what you do best, and you do it again and again." While Taylor and Hornung were running toward records at season's end, Lombardi realized that his Packers would rise only as high as their quarterback could take them. He would often tell his cronies at dinner that football was the perfect team game except for one glaring imbalance. The quarterback was too important. A pitcher might be more dominant in baseball, but a baseball team had a staff of pitchers. There was only one quarterback. A goalie was pivotal in hockey, but a goalie didn't have to call plays or worry about much beyond his own performance. To win in the pros, Lombardi said, you needed a quarterback who could be a coach on the field, someone who was intelligent, rational, unflappable, and occasionally daring, as well as a gifted passer. Did Bart Starr have those characteristics? Lombardi had vacillated on that question for nearly 2 years. His first impression of Starr, he once acknowledged, was that he was probably just a little too polite and maybe a little too self-effacing to be the real, bold, tough quarterback that a quarterback must be in the National Football League. Starr felt otherwise, and was determined to prove himself to Lombardi no matter how long it took. I could see in my own mind, day by day, week by week, that this was going to be a lengthy process because trust and respect should never just be handed out to somebody, Starr said later. You have to earn it. If he lacked the raw talent of many other quarterbacks, he thought that he could compensate by working harder and overachieving. The more Starr studied Lombardi's system, the more convinced he became that he could flourish in it. Other players barely tolerated the classroom aspects of practice, endless hours of studying film and analyzing plays. Starr could not get enough of it. I loved it. I loved the meetings. I never ever was bored or tired at any meeting we were in with Lombardi. I appreciated what he was trying to teach. He was always raising the bar. If anyone could have been prepared for Lombardi's methods, it was Bart Starr. After what Starr had endured at home with his father in Alabama, Lombardi's treatment of him seemed benign. Ben Starr was a stern military man who had drilled his sons, Brian Bartlett, Bart,
and Hilton Bubba in the practice of obedience and respect for elders. No differing points of view were allowed in the Star household. Everyone was expected to do and say exactly what the family Master Sergeant demanded. Bart, the oldest son, worried that he could never do quite enough. No matter how hard he tried, he felt that he couldn't win his father's love or respect. It wasn't Bart, but his younger brother Bubba, who was considered the vessel of his father's ambitions. Bubba was more athletic, stronger, decisive, and fearless. Bart seemed too mediocre for Ben Starr. But Bubba died at age 13, before he could show the world much. The death of a child is devastating to any family. Bubba's death was particularly traumatic for the Stars. He'd been playing barefoot in a vacant field and was cut on the heel by an old dog bone and died of tetanus 3 days later. Bubba's mother had been reluctant to bring him in for the shot that would have saved his life, and she was plagued by guilt thereafter. And his father, believing that his dreams were lost with Bubba's death, didn't turn to Bart as his new hope, but rather shunned or belittled him even more. Ben Starr wasn't the only one who doubted Bart's talents. He always seemed to be struggling to prove himself to older men. During his high school years, he had to grind his way past several more talented boys who were favored by the coaches to play quarterback. At the University of Alabama, he was sidelined by an injury during his junior year, just when he was starting to perform well, then had the misfortune of playing under a new coach who benched him for his senior season, even as the team lost 10 straight, the worst record in Crimson Tide history. As a local boy, he was put on the gray roster for the blue-gray all-star game in Montgomery, but barely got in and cried in frustration afterwards. Somehow, Jack Vanisi had heard enough about Starr to recommend him to the Packers, who made him the 199th college player selected in the pro draft. He floundered in Green Bay under coaches Liz Blackburn and Scooter McLean until Lombardi arrived and detected the same glimmer of promise that Vanisi had seen. Starr had flashes of brilliance when given an opportunity to play quarterback late in Lombardi's first year, but then seemed to regress and was benched again after the 1960 season-opening loss to the Bears. That was a real wake-up call for me, a real punch in the side, Starr said of his benching. I'd let him down. Here's the man who had brought me along and given me the opportunity, and I failed when I got the chance. So I was even more determined to get it back. Much as he had the first year, he used his time on the bench productively, studying the defenses and the best ways to respond to them. When his time came again, as the Packers began their drive for the conference crown, he was ready, mentally and physically. Ready even to stand up to his coach and prove that he had the toughness needed for the job. The change in their relationship came in practice one day when Starr threw an interception, one too many as far as Lombardi was concerned. The coach exploded at Starr in front of his teammates. When practice was over, Starr approached Lombardi in his office and asserted himself in a way that he'd never done before. The intercepted ball was tipped, he pointed out. It was not his fault. Furthermore, Starr said, the coach should change his habit of yelling at players in public and then, if necessary, making up with them in private. You're asking me to be the leader of this team, and I'm challenged by that, and I want to be the best leader I can be. But I can't be if you're chewing my butt out in front of the team you want me to lead, Starr explained to the coach. You'll see later, when the coaches watched film of the practice, that the error was yours. The ball was tipped by a defender and intercepted. I can take any ass-chewing you want to deliver, and if you feel I have it coming, have at it. But please do it in the privacy of your office here, where you make your apologies to me. I will be an even better leader for you
if you do that. Lombardi listened quietly. I hear you, he said contritely, when his quarterback had finished his complaint. The challenge